Tantor Audio presents This Idea Must Die, Scientific Theories That Are Blocking Progress. Edited by John Brockman. Narrated by David Colacci and Susan Erickson. The 2014 Edge Question. Science advances by discovering new things and developing new ideas. Few truly new ideas are developed without abandoning old ones first. As theoretical physicist Max Planck, 1858 through 1947, noted, a new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it. In other words, science advances by a series of funerals. Why wait that long? What scientific idea is ready for retirement? Ideas change, and the times we live in change. Perhaps the biggest change today is the rate of change. What established scientific idea is ready to be moved aside so that science can advance? The theory of everything. Jeffrey West, theoretical physicist. Distinguished professor and past president, Santa Fe Institute. Everything? Well, wait a minute. Questioning a theory of everything may be beating a dead horse, since I'm certainly not the first to be bothered by its implicit hyperbole. But let's face it, referring to one's field of study as the theory of everything smacks of arrogance and naivete. Although it's been around for only a relatively short period, it may already be dying a natural death, the phrase, though certainly not the endeavor, should be retired from serious scientific literature and discourse. Let me elaborate. The search for grand syntheses, for commonalities, regularities, ideas, and concepts transcending the narrow confines of specific problems or disciplines is one of the great inspirational drivers of science and scientists. Arguably, it is also a defining characteristic of Homo sapiens sapiens. Perhaps the binomial form of sapiens is some distorted poetic recognition of this. Like the invention of gods and God, the concept of a theory of everything connotes the grandest vision of all, the inspiration of all inspirations, namely, that we can encapsulate and understand the entirety of the universe in a small set of precepts, in this case, a concise set of mathematical equations. Like the concept of God, however, it's potentially misleading and intellectually dangerous. Among the classic grand syntheses in science are Newton's laws, which taught us that heavenly laws were no different than the earthly. Maxwell's unification of electricity and magnetism, which brought the ephemeral ether into our lives. Darwin's theory of natural selection, which reminded us that we're just animals and plants after all, and the laws of thermodynamics, which suggest we can't go on forever. Each of these has had profound consequences, not only in changing the way we think about the world, but also in laying the foundations for technological advancements that have led to the standard of living many of us are privileged to enjoy. Nevertheless, they're all, to varying degrees, incomplete. Indeed, understanding the boundaries of their applicability and the limits of their predictive power and the ongoing search for exceptions, violations, and failures have provoked even deeper questions and challenges, stimulating the continued progress of science and the unfolding of new ideas, techniques, and concepts. One of the great scientific challenges is the search for a grand unified theory of the elementary particles and their interactions, including its extension to understanding the cosmos and even the origin of space-time itself. Such a theory would be based on a parsimonious set of underlying mathematizable universal principles that integrate and explain all the fundamental forces of nature, from gravity and electromagnetism to the weak and strong nuclear forces, incorporating Newton's laws, quantum mechanics, and general relativity. Fundamental quantities like the speed of light, the dimensionality of space-time, and the masses of the elementary particles would all be predicted, and the equations governing the origin and evolution of the universe through to the formation of galaxies and beyond would be derived, and so on. This constitutes the theory of everything. It's a truly remarkable and enormously ambitious quest, which has occupied thousands of researchers for over 50 years at a cost of billions of dollars. Measured by almost any metric, this quest, which is still far from its ultimate goal, has been enormously successful, leading, for example, to the discovery of quarks and the Higgs boson, to black holes and the Big Bang, to quantum chromodynamics and string theory, and to many Nobel Prizes. But everything? Well, hardly. Where's life? Where are animals and cells, brains and consciousness, cities and corporations, love and hate, etc., etc.? How does the extraordinary diversity and complexity seen here on Earth arise? The simplistic answer is that these are inevitable outcomes of the interactions and dynamics encapsulated in the theory. Time evolves from the geometry and dynamics of strings, the universe expands and cools, and the hierarchy, from quarks to nucleons to atoms and molecules, to cells, brains, and emotions, and all the rest, comes tumbling out, a sort of deus ex machina, a result of just turning the crank of increasingly complicated equations and computations, presumed in principle to be soluble to any sufficient degree of accuracy. Qualitatively, this extreme version of reductionism may have some validity. But something is missing. The something includes concepts like information, emergence, accidents, historical contingency, adaptation, and selection, all characteristics of complex adaptive systems, whether organisms, societies, ecosystems, or economies. These are composed of myriad individual constituents or agents which take on collective characteristics generally unpredictable, certainly in detail, from their underlying components, even if the interactive dynamics are known. Unlike the Newtonian paradigm, on which the theory of everything is based, the complete dynamics and structure of complex adaptive systems cannot be encoded in a small number of equations. Indeed, in most cases, probably not even in an infinite number. Furthermore, predictions to arbitrary degrees of accuracy are not possible, even in principle. Perhaps, then, the most surprising consequence of a visionary theory of everything is that it implies that on the grand scale, the universe, including its origins and evolution, although extremely complicated, is not complex, but in fact surprisingly simple, since it can be encoded in a limited number of equations. Conceivably, only one. This is in stark contrast to what we encounter here on Earth, where we're integral to some of the most diverse, complex, and messy phenomena occurring anywhere in the universe, and which require additional, possibly non-mathematizable, concepts to understand. So, while applauding and admiring the search for a grand unified theory of all the basic forces of nature, let's drop the implication that it can, in principle, explain and predict everything. Let us instead incorporate a parallel quest for a grand unified theory of complexity. The challenge of developing a quantitative, analytic, principled, predictive framework for understanding complex adaptive systems is surely a grand challenge for the 21st century. Like all grand syntheses, it will inevitably remain incomplete, but nevertheless it will undoubtedly inspire significant, possibly revolutionary, new ideas, concepts, and techniques. Unification. Marcelo Gleiser, theoretical physicist, Dartmouth College, author, The Island of Knowledge, The Limits of Science and the Search for Meaning. There, I said it. The venerable notion of unification needs to go. I don't mean the smaller unifications we scientists search for all the time, connecting as few principles with as many natural phenomena as possible. This sort of scientific economy is a major foundational stone for what we do. We search and we simplify. Over the centuries, scientists have done wonders following this motto. Newton's law of universal gravity, The laws of thermodynamics, electromagnetism, universal behavior in phase transitions. The trouble starts when we take this idea too far and search for the uber-unification, the theory of everything, the arch-reductionist notion that all forces of nature are merely manifestations of a single force. This is the idea that needs to go. And I say this with a heavy heart. My early career aspirations and formative years were very much fueled by the impulse to unify it all. The idea of unification is quite old as Western philosophy. Thales, the first pre-Socratic philosopher, posited that all is water, thus dreaming up a single material principle to describe all of nature. Plato proposed elusive geometrical forms as the archetypal structures behind all there is. Math became equated with beauty, and beauty with truth. From there, the highest of the post-Plato aspirations was to erect a purely mathematical explanation for all there is, the all-encompassing cosmic blueprint, the masterwork of a supreme intelligence. Needless to say, the whole thing was always about our intelligence, even if often attributed to some foggy mind of God metaphor. We explain the world the way we think about it. There's no way out of our minds. The impulse to unify it all runs deep in the souls of mathematicians and theoretical physicists, from the Langlands program to superstring theory. But here's the rub. Pure mathematics isn't physics. The power of mathematics comes precisely from its detachment from physical reality. A mathematician can create any universe she wants and play all sorts of games with it. A physicist can't. His job is to describe nature as we perceive it. Nevertheless, the unification game has been an integral part of physics since Galileo and has produced what it should: approximate unifications. Yes, even the most sacred of our unifications are only approximations. Take, for example, electromagnetism. The equations describing electricity and magnetism are perfectly symmetric only in the absence of any sources of charge or magnetism, that is, in empty space. Or take the famous and beautiful standard model of particle physics, based on the unification of electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force. Here again, we don't have a real unification, since the theory retains two forces all along. In more technical jargon, there are two coupling constants and two gauge groups. A real unification, such as the conjectured grand unification between the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic forces proposed 40 years ago, remains unfulfilled. So what's going on? Why do so many insist on finding the one in nature, while nature keeps telling us that it's really about the many? For one thing, the scientific impulse to unify is crypto-religious. The West has bathed in monotheism for thousands of years, and even in polytheistic cultures there's always an alpha god in charge: Zeus, Ra, Parabrahman. For another, there's something deeply appealing in equating all of nature to a single creative principle. To decipher the mind of God is to be special, is to answer to a higher calling. Pure mathematicians who believe in the reality of mathematical truths are monks of a secret order, open only to the initiated. In the case of high-energy physics, all unification theories rely on sophisticated mathematics related to pure geometric structures. The belief is that nature's ultimate code exists in the ethereal world of mathematical truths, and that we can decipher it. Recent experimental data has been devastating to such belief. No trace of supersymmetric particles, of extra dimensions, or of dark matter of any sort. All long-awaited signatures of unification physics. Maybe something will come up. To find, we must search. The trouble with unification in high-energy physics is that you can always push it beyond the experimental range. The Large Hadron Collider got to 70 eV and found nothing? No problem. Who said nature should opt for the simplest versions of unification? Maybe it's all happening at much higher energies, well beyond our reach. There's nothing wrong with this kind of position. You can believe it until you die and die happy. Or you can conclude that what we do best is construct approximate models of how nature works and that the symmetries we find are only descriptions of what really goes on. Perfection is too hard a burden to impose on nature. People often see this kind of argument as defeatist, as coming from someone who got frustrated and gave up, as in he lost his faith. Big mistake. To search for simplicity is essential to what scientists do. It's what I do. There are essential organizing principles in nature, and the laws we find are excellent ways to describe them. But the laws are many, not one. We're successful, pattern-seeking, rational mammals. That alone is cause for celebration. However, let's not confuse our descriptions and models with reality. We may hold perfection in our mind's eye as a sort of ethereal muse. Meanwhile, nature is out there doing its thing. That we manage to catch a glimpse of its inner workings is nothing short of wonderful. And that should be good enough. Simplicity. A.C. Grayling, philosopher, founder and master, New College of the Humanities, London, supernumerary fellow, St. Anne's College, Oxford, author, The Good Argument, The Case Against Religion and for Humanism. When two hypotheses are equally adequate to the data and equal in predictive power, extra-theoretical criteria for choosing between them might come into play. They include not just questions about best fit with other hypotheses or theories already predicated to inquiry, but also the aesthetic qualities of the competing hypotheses themselves, which is more pleasing, more elegant, more beautiful, and, of course, the question of which of them is simpler. Simplicity is a desideratum in science, and the quest for it is a driver in the task of effecting reductions of complex phenomena to their components. It lies behind the assumption that there must be a single force in nature of which the gravitational, electroweak, and strong nuclear forces are merely manifestations. And this assumption, in turn, is an instance of the general view that there might ultimately be a single kind of thing, or stuff, or field, or as yet undreamt of phenomenon, out of which variety springs by means of principles themselves fundamental and simple. Compelling as the idea of simplicity is, there's no guarantee that nature itself has as much interest in simplicity as those attempting to describe it. If the idea of emergent properties still has purchase, biological entities cannot be fully explained except in terms of them, which means in their full complexity, even though considerations of structure and composition are indispensable. Two measures of complexity are the length of the message required to describe a given phenomenon and the length of the evolutionary history of that phenomenon. On a certain view, that makes a Jackson Pollock painting complex by the first measure, simple by the second, whereas a smooth pebble on a beach is simple by the first and complex by the second. The simplicity sought in science might be thought to be what is achieved by reducing the length of the descriptive message, encapsulation in an equation, for example. But could there be an inverse relationship between the degree of simplicity achieved and the degree of approximation that results? Of course, it would be nice if everything in the end turned out to be simple or could be made amenable to simple description. But some things might be better or more adequately explained in their complexity. Biological systems again come to mind. Resisting too dissipative a form of reductionism might ward off those silly kinds of criticism claiming that science aims to see nothing in the pearl but the disease of the oyster. The Universe. Seth Lloyd, Professor of Quantum Mechanical Engineering, MIT. Author, Programming the Universe. I know. The universe has been around for 13.8 billion years and is likely to survive for another 100 billion years or more. Plus, where would the universe retire to? Florida isn't big enough. But it's time to retire the 2,500-year-old scientific idea of the universe as the single volume of space and time that contains everything. 21st-century cosmology strongly suggests that what we see in the cosmos, stars, galaxies, space, and time since the Big Bang, does not encompass all of reality. Cosmos, buy the condo. What is the universe anyway? To test your knowledge of the universe, please complete the following sentence. The universe, A, consists of all things visible and invisible, what is, has been, and will be. B, began 13.8 billion years ago in a giant explosion called the Big Bang and encompasses all planets, stars, galaxies, space, and time. C, was licked out of the salty rim of the primordial fiery pit by the tongue of a giant cow. D. All of the above. The idea of the universe as an observed and measured thing has persisted for thousands of years. Those observations and measurements have been so successful that today we know more about the origin of the universe than we do about the origin of life on Earth. But the success of observational cosmology has brought us to a point where it's no longer possible to identify the universe, in the sense of answer A above, with the observed cosmos, answer B. The same observations that establish the detailed history of the universe imply that the observed cosmos is a vanishingly small fraction of an infinite universe. The finite amount of time since the Big Bang means that our observations extend only a little more than 10 billion light-years from Earth. Beyond the horizon of our observation lies more of the same, space filled with galaxies stretching on forever. No matter how long the universe exists, we will have access to only a finite part, while an infinite amount of universe remains beyond our ken. All but an infinitesimal fraction of the universe is unknowable. That's a blow. The scientific concept universe equals observable universe has thrown in the towel. Perhaps that's okay. What's not to like about a universe encompassing infinite unknowable space? But the hits keep coming. As cosmologists delve deeper into the past, they find more and more clues that, for better or worse, there's more out there than just the infinite space beyond our horizon. Extrapolating backward in time to the Big Bang, cosmologists have identified an epoch called inflation, in which the universe doubled in size many times over a tiny fraction of a second. The vast majority of space-time consists of this rapidly expanding stuff. Our own universe, infinite as it is just a bubble that has nucleated in this inflationary sea. It gets worse. The inflationary sea contains an infinity of other bubbles, each an infinite universe in its own right. In different bubbles, the laws of physics can take different forms. Somewhere out there in another bubble universe, the electron has a different mass. In another bubble, electrons don't exist. Because it consists not of one cosmos but of many, the multi-bubble universe is often called a multiverse. The promiscuous nature of the multiverse may be unappealing. William James, who coined the word, called the multiverse a harlot. But it's hard to eliminate. As a final insult to unity, the laws of quantum mechanics indicate that the universe is continually splitting into multiple histories, or many worlds, out of which the world we experience is only one. The other worlds contain the events that didn't happen in our world. After a 2-millennium run, the universe as observable cosmos is kaput. Beyond what we can see, an infinite array of galaxies exists. Beyond that infinite array, an infinite number of bubble universes bounce and pop in the inflationary sea. Closer by, but utterly inaccessible, the many worlds of quantum mechanics branch and propagate. MIT cosmologist Max Tegmark calls these three kinds of proliferating realities the Type 1, Type 2, and Type 3 multiverses. Where will it all end? Somehow, a single, accessible universe seemed more dignified. There's hope, however. Multiplicity itself represents a kind of unity. We now know that the universe contains more things than we can ever see, hear, or touch. Rather than regarding the multiplicity of physical realities as a problem, let's take it as an opportunity. Suppose that everything that could exist does exist. The multiverse is not a bug, but a feature. We have to be careful. The set of everything that could exist belongs to the realm of metaphysics rather than physics. Tegmark and I have shown that with a minor restriction, however, we can pull back from the metaphysical edge. Suppose that the physical multiverse contains all the things that are locally finite in the sense that any finite piece of the thing can be described by a finite amount of information. The set of locally finite things is mathematically well defined. It consists of things whose behavior can be simulated on a computer, more specifically on a quantum computer. Because they're locally finite, the universe we observe and the various other universes are all contained within this computational universe. As is, somewhere, a giant cow. The answer to the quiz? C. IQ. Scott Atran, anthropologist, Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique, Paris, author, Talking to the Enemy, Religion, Brotherhood, and the Unmaking of Terrorists. There's no reason to believe, and much reason not to believe, that the measure of a so-called intelligence quotient in any way reflects some basic cognitive capacity or natural kind of the human mind. The domain general measure of IQ isn't motivated by any recent discovery of cognitive or developmental psychology. It thoroughly confounds domain-specific abilities, distinct mental capacities for, say, geometrical and spatial reasoning about shapes and positions, mechanical reasoning about mass and motion, taxonomic reasoning about biological kinds, social reasoning about other people's beliefs and desires, and so on, which are the only sorts of cognitive abilities for which an evolutionary account seems plausible in terms of natural selection for task-specific competencies. Nowhere in the animal or plant kingdoms does there ever appear to have been natural selection for a task-general adaptation. An overall measure of intelligence or mental competence is akin to an overall measure for the body, taking no special account of the various and specific bodily organs and functions, such as hearts, lungs, stomach, circulation, respiration, digestion, and so on. A doctor or biologist presented with a single measure for body quotient, BQ, wouldn't be able to make much of it. IQ is a general measure of socially acceptable categorization and reasoning skills. IQ tests were designed in behaviorism's heyday, when there was little interest in cognitive structure. The scoring system was tooled to generate a normal distribution of scores with a mean of 100 and a standard deviation of 15. In other societies, a normal distribution of some general measure of social intelligence might look very different. Some normal members of our society could well produce a score that's a standard deviation from normal members of another society on that other society's test. For example, in forced choice tasks, East Asian students, Chinese, Koreans, Japanese, tend to favor field-dependent perception over object-salient perception, thematic reasoning over taxonomic reasoning, and exemplar-based categorization over rule-based categorization. American students generally prefer the opposite. On tests measuring these various categorization and reasoning skills, East Asians average higher on their preferences and Americans average higher on theirs. There's nothing particularly revealing about these different distributions other than that they reflect underlying socio-cultural differences. There's a long history of acrimonious debate over which, if any, aspects of IQ are heritable. The most compelling studies concern twins raised apart and adoptions. Twin studies rarely have large sample populations. Moreover, they often involve twins separated at birth because a parent dies or cannot afford to support both, and one is given over to be raised by relatives, friends, or neighbors. This disallows ruling out the effects of social environment and upbringing in producing convergence among the twins. The chief problem with adoption studies is that the mere fact of adoption reliably increases IQ, regardless of any correlation between the IQs of the children and those of their biological parents. Nobody has the slightest causal account of how or why genes, singly or in combination, might affect IQ. I don't think it's because the problem is too hard, but because IQ is a specious rather than a natural kind. Brain Plasticity. Leo M. Chalupa, Vice President of Research, George Washington University. Brain plasticity refers to the ability of neurons to change their structural and functional properties with experience. That hardly seems surprising, since every part of the body changes with age. What's special about brain plasticity, but not unique to this organ, is that the changes are mediated by events that are in some sense adaptive. The field of brain plasticity primarily derives from the pioneering studies of Torsten Wiesel and David Hubel, who showed that depriving one eye of normal visual input during early development resulted in a loss of functional connections of that eye with the visual cortex, while the connections of the eye not deprived of visual input expanded. These studies convincingly demonstrated that early brain connections aren't hardwired, but can be modified by early experience, hence they're plastic. For this work and related studies done in the 1960s, Wiesel and Hubel received the 1981 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. Since that time, there have been thousands of studies showing a wide diversity of neuronal changes in virtually every region of the brain, ranging from the molecular to the systems level, in young, adult, and elderly subjects. As a result, by the end of the 20th century, our view of the brain had evolved from the hardwired to the seemingly ever-changeable. Today, plasticity is one of the most commonly used words in the neuroscience literature. Indeed, I've employed this term many times in my own research articles and used it in the titles of some of my edited books. So what's wrong with that, you may ask? For one thing, the widespread application of brain plasticity to virtually every type of change in neuronal structure and function has rendered the term largely meaningless. When almost any change in neurons is characterized as plasticity, the term encompasses so much that it no longer conveys any useful information. Moreover, many studies invoke brain plasticity as the underlying cause of modified behavioral states without having any direct evidence for neuronal changes. Particularly egregious are the studies showing improvement in performance on some particular task with practice. The fact that practice improves performance was noted before anything was known about the brain. Does it really add anything to state that improvements in function demonstrate a remarkable degree of brain plasticity? The word remarkable is often used to denote practice effects in seniors, as if those old enough to receive Social Security are incapable of showing enhanced performance with training. Studies of this type have led to the launch of the brain training industry. Many of these programs are focused on the very young. Particularly popular in past years was the Mozart effect, which led parents without any interest in classical music themselves to continually play pieces by Mozart to their infants. This movement seems to have abated, replaced by a plethora of games supposed to improve the brains of children of all ages. But the largest growth in the brain plasticity industry has focused on the aging brain. Given the concerns most of us have about memory loss and decreasing cognitive abilities with age, this is understandable. There are large profits to be made, as is evident from the number of companies that have proliferated in this sector in recent years. There is, of course, nothing wrong in having children or seniors engage in activities that challenge their cognitive functions. In fact, there may be some genuine benefits in doing so. Certainly, undergoing such training is preferable to watching television for hours each day. It's also the case that any and all changes in performance reflect some underlying changes in the brain. How could it be otherwise, since the brain controls all behaviors? But as yet, we don't know what occurs in the brain when performance on a specific video game improves, nor do we understand how to make such changes long-lasting and generalizable to diverse cognitive states. Terming such efforts brain training or enhanced brain plasticity is often just hype intended to sell a product. This doesn't mean the so-called brain exercises should be abandoned. They're unlikely to cause harm and may even do some good. But please refrain from invoking brain plasticity, remarkable or otherwise, to explain the resulting improvements. Changing the Brain. Howard Gardner, Hobbs Professor of Cognition and Education, Harvard Graduate School of Education. Author, Truth, Beauty, and Goodness, Reframed. When I speak to students or lay audiences about any kind of digital innovation, the feedback from my listeners goes roughly, "Do smartphones change the brain?" Or, "We can't let infants play with pads because it might affect their brains." I try to explain that everything we do affects the nervous system, and that their comments are therefore either meaningless or need to be unpacked. Here is one such unpacking. Does this experience affect the nervous system significantly and perhaps even permanently? Another. Do you mean affect the mind or affect the brain? When the questioner looks blank, I sense that he or she needs a refresher course in philosophy, psychology, and neuroscience.
The Rocket Scientist. Victoria Wyatt, Associate Professor of Indigenous Arts of North America, University of Victoria. It's time to retire the rocket scientist of cliché fame. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to... The rocket scientist is a personage rather than a principle, and a fictitious personage at that. He or she was constructed by popular usage, not by scientists. Still, the cliché perpetuates outdated public perceptions of scientific principles, and that's critical. The rocket scientist needs a good retirement party. I'll start with a disclaimer. My dreams of that retirement gala may appear tinged with professional envy. I've never heard anyone say, "It doesn't take an ethnohistorian to..." I never will. So, yes, the cliché does slight the humanities, but that's not my concern. Rather, the rocket scientist, as popularly conceived, dangerously slights the sciences. Our Earth cannot afford that. The rocket scientist stands outside society, frozen on a higher plane. Widely embraced and often repeated, the cliché reflects the public's comfort with divorcing science from personal experience. The cliché imposes a boundary of brilliance between the scientist and everyone else. This makes for popular movies and television shows, but it's insidious. Artificially constructed boundaries isolate. They focus attention on differences and distinctions. In contrast, the exploration of relationships and process feeds rapid scientific developments. Systems, biology, epigenetics, neurology and brain research, astronomy, medicine, quantum physics. Complex relationships also shape the urgent challenges we face. Global epidemics, climate change, species extinction, finite resources. These all comprise integral interconnections. Approaching such problems demands an appreciation of diversity, complexity, relationships, and process. Popular understanding of contemporary science demands the same. We can address urgent global issues only when policymakers see science clearly, when they view diversity, complexity, relationships, and process as essential to understanding rather than as obstacles to it. At present, though, Constructed boundaries pervade not just our clichés, but also our institutions and policy structures. Examples abound. Universities segment researchers and students into disciplinary compartments with discrete budgetary line items, competing for scarce resources. Interdisciplinary makes a good buzzword, but the paradigm on which our institutions rest militates against it. The model of nations negotiating as autonomous entities has failed abysmally to address climate change. In my provincial government's bureaucracy, separate divisions oversee oceans and forests, as if a fatal barrier sliced the ecosystem at the tide line. Time suffers too. Past gets alienated from present, and present from future, as our society zooms in on short-term fiscal and political deadlines. Fragmented time informs all other challenges and makes them all the more dire. So much of our society still operates on a paradigm of simplification, compartmentalization, and boundaries, when we need a paradigm of diversity, complexity, relationships, and process. Our societal structures fundamentally conflict with the messages of contemporary science. How can policymakers address crucial global issues while ignoring contemporary scientific principles? The real world plays out as a video. The relationships between frames make the story comprehensible. In contrast, the rocket scientist stands fictitiously yet firmly alone on a lofty pinnacle apart from society, not a part of it. Yes, it's just a cliché, but language matters and jokes instruct. It's time for the rocket scientist to retire. I'll close with another disclaimer. I mean no offense to real rocket scientists. Some of my best friends have been rocket scientists. Real rocket scientists exist. They inhabit the real world with all the attending interconnections, relationships, and complexities. The rocket scientist embodies the opposite. We'd all be well served by that retirement.
Individuality. Nigel Goldenfeld, Center for Advanced Study Professor in Physics, Director, Institute for Universal Biology, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. In physics, we use the convention that the suffix "on" denotes a quantized unit of something. For example, in classical physics, there are electromagnetic waves. But in the quantum version of the theory, originating with Einstein's 1905 Nobel Prize-winning work, we know that under certain circumstances, it's more precise to regard electromagnetic radiant energy as being distributed in particles called photons. This wave-particle duality is the underpinning of modern physics. Not just photons, but a zoo of what were once called elementary particles that include protons, neutrons, pions, mesons, and of course the Higgs boson. Neutrino, it's a long story. And what about you? You're a person. Are you a quantum of something too? Well, clearly there are no fractional humans, and we are trivially quantized. But elementary particles, or units, are useful conceptually because they can be considered in isolation, devoid of interactions, like point particles in an ideal gas. You would certainly not fulfill that description, networked, online, and cultured, as you undoubtedly are. Your strong interaction with other humans means that your individuality is complicated by the fact that you're part of a society and can function properly only in such a milieu. We could go further and say you're a quantum of a spatially distributed field, one that describes the density around each point in space of humans rather than the electromagnetic field intensity. This description turns out to be technically powerful for describing the behavior of ecosystems in space and time, particularly for describing extinction, where discontinuous change is important. It seems apt to invoke here the strangely oxymoronic term individuality, a counterpart to wave-particle duality. The notion of individual has several other connotations. It can mean discrete or single, but its etymology is also reminiscent of indivisible. Clearly, we're not indivisible, but constituted from cells, which are themselves constituted of cytoplasm, nucleic acids, proteins, etc., themselves constituted of atoms, which contain neutrons, protons, electrons, all the way down to the elementary particles now believed to be products of string theory, itself now known not to be a final description of matter. In other words, it's turtles all the way down, and there are no indivisible units of matter, no meaning to the notion of elementary particle, no place to stop. Everything is made of something, and so on ad infinitum. However, this doesn't mean that everything is simply the sum of its parts. Take the proton, for example, which is made up of three quarks. It has a type of intrinsic angular momentum called spin, which was initially expected to be the sum of that of its constituent quarks. Yet experiments carried out over the last 20 or 30 years have shown that this is not the case. The spin arises out of some shared collective aspect of the quarks and short-lived fluctuating particles called gluons. The notion of individual quarks is not useful when the collective behavior is so strong. The proton is made of something, but its properties aren't found by adding up the properties of its parts. When we try to identify something, we discover that, as some say of Los Angeles, there's no there there. You probably already knew that naive reductionism is often too simplistic. However, there's another point. It's not just that you're a composite, something you already knew, but you're in some senses not even human. You have perhaps 100 trillion bacterial cells in your body, numbering 10 times more than your human cells, and containing 100 times as many genes as your human cells. These bacteria aren't just passive occupants of the zoo that is you. They self-organize into communities within your mouth, guts, and elsewhere, and these communities, microbiomes, are maintained by varied dynamic patterns of competition and cooperation between the various bacteria, which allows us to live. In the last few years, genomics has given us a tool to explore the microbiome by identifying microbes by their DNA sequences. The story emerging from these studies is not yet complete, but it has already led to fascinating insights. Thanks to its microbes, a baby can better digest its mother's milk. And your ability to digest carbohydrates relies to a significant extent on enzymes that can be made only by genes present not in you, but in your microbiome. Your microbiome can be disrupted, for example, due to treatment by antibiotics, and in extreme cases can be invaded by dangerous monocultures, such as Clostridium difficile, leading to your death. Perhaps the most remarkable finding is the gut-brain axis. Your gastrointestinal microbiome can generate small molecules that may be able to pass through the blood-brain barrier and affect the state of your brain. Although the precise mechanism isn't yet clear, there's growing evidence that your microbiome may be a significant factor in mental states, such as depression and autism spectrum conditions. In short, you may be a collective property arising from the close interactions of your constituents. Now, maybe it's true that you're not an individual in one sense of the word, but how about your microbes? Well, it turns out that your microbes are a strongly interacting system, too. They form dense colonies within you and not only exchange chemicals for metabolism, but communicate by emitting molecules. They can even transfer genes between themselves, and in some cases do that in response to signals emitted by a hopeful recipient, a bacterial cry for help. A single microbe in isolation doesn't do these things. Thus, these complex behaviors are a property of the collective and not the individual microbes. Even microbes that seem to be from the same nominal species can have genomes differing in content by as much as 60% of their genes. So much for the intuitive notion of species. That's another too anthropomorphic scientific idea that doesn't apply to most of life. Up to now, I've talked about connections in space, but there are also connections in time. If the stuff that makes the universe is strongly connected in space and not usefully thought of as the aggregate sum of its parts, then attributing a cause of an event to a specific component may not be meaningful either. Just as you can't attribute the spin of a proton to any one of its constituents, you can't attribute an event in time to a single earlier cause. Complex systems have neither a useful notion of individuality nor a proper notion of causality. The bigger an animal's brain, the greater its intelligence. Nicholas Humphrey, psychologist, Darwin College, Cambridge, author, Soul Dust, The Magic of Consciousness. The bigger an animal's brain, the greater its intelligence. You may think the connection is obvious. Just look at the evolutionary lineage of human beings. Humans have bigger brains and are cleverer than chimpanzees, and chimpanzees have bigger brains and are cleverer than monkeys. Or, as an analogy, look at the history of computing machines in the 20th century. The bigger the machines, the greater their number-crunching powers. In the 1970s, the new computer at my university department took up a whole room. From the phrenology of the 19th century to the brain scan sciences of the 21st, it has indeed been widely assumed that brain volume determines cognitive capacity. In particular, you'll find the idea repeated in every modern textbook that the brain size of different primate species is causally related to their social intelligence. I admit I'm partly responsible for this, having championed the idea back in the 1970s. Yet for a good many years now, I've had a hunch that the idea is wrong. There are too many awkward facts that don't fit in. For a start, we know that modern humans can be born with only 2/3 the normal volume of brain tissue and show next to no cognitive deficit as adults. We know that during normal human brain development, the brain actually shrinks as cognitive performance improves, a notable example being changes in the social brain during adolescence, where the cortical gray matter decreases in volume by about 15% between ages 10 and 20. And most surprising of all, we know that there are non-human animals, such as honeybees or parrots, that can emulate many feats of human intelligence with brains only a millionth, bee, or a thousandth, parrot, the size of a human's. The key, of course, is programming. What really matters to cognitive performance isn't so much the brain's hardware as its onboard software. And smarter software doesn't need a bigger hardware base. In fact, as the shrinkage of the cortex during adolescence shows, it may actually need a smaller, tidier one. It's true that programs to deliver superior performance may require a lot of designing, either by natural selection or learning. But once they've been invented, they'll likely make fewer demands on hardware than the older versions. To take the special case of social intelligence, I'd say it's quite possible that the algorithm for solving theory of mind problems could be written on the back of a postcard and implemented on an iPhone. In which case, the widely touted suggestion that the human brain had to double in size for humans to be capable of second-order mind reading makes little sense. Then why did the human brain double in size? Why is it much bigger than you might think it needs to be to underpin our level of intelligence? There's no question that big brains are costly to build and maintain. So if we're to retire the obvious theory, what can we put in its place? The answer, I'd suggest, lies in the advantage of having a large amount of cognitive reserve. Big brains have spare capacity that can be called on if and when working parts get damaged or wear out. From adulthood onward, humans, like other mammals, begin to lose a significant amount of brain tissue to accidents, hemorrhages, and degeneration. But because humans can draw on this reserve, the loss doesn't have to show. This means humans can retain their mental powers into relative old age, long after their smaller-brained ancestors would have become incapacitated. And, as a matter of fact, the unfortunate individual born with an unusually small brain is much more likely to succumb to senile dementia in his 40s. True, many of us die for other reasons, with unused brain power to spare. But some of us live considerably longer than we might have done if our brains were half the size. So what evolutionary advantage does longevity bring, even the post-reproductive longevity typical of humans? The answer, surely, is that humans can benefit, as no other species could do, from the presence of mentally sound grandparents and great-grandparents, whose role in caretaking and teaching has been the key to the success of human culture. The Big Bang was the first moment of time. Lee Smolin, physicist, Perimeter Institute, Waterloo, Ontario. Author, Time Reborn. In my field of fundamental physics and cosmology, the idea most ready for retirement is that the Big Bang was the first moment of time. In popular parlance, the Big Bang has two meanings. First, Big Bang cosmology is the hypothesis that our universe has been expanding for 13.8 billion years from an extremely hot and dense primordial state more extreme than the center of a star, or indeed than anywhere now existing. This I have no quarrel with. It's established scientific fact, which has been elaborated into a detailed story narrating the expansion of the universe from a uniform and dense hot plasma to the beautifully varied and complex world that is our home. We have detailed theories that pass numerous observational tests and explain the origins of all the structures we see, from the elements to galaxies, stars, planets, and the molecular building blocks of life. As in any good scientific theory, there are questions still to be answered, such as the precise nature of the dark matter and dark energy, which are prominent actors in the story, or the very interesting question of whether or not there was an early phase of inflationary exponential expansion. But these don't suggest that the basic picture is wrong. What concerns me is the other meaning of Big Bang, which is the further hypothesis that the ultimate origin of our universe was a first moment of time at which our universe was launched from a state of infinite density and temperature. According to this idea, nothing that exists is older than 13.8 billion years. It makes no sense to ask what was before that, because before that, there wasn't even time. The main problem with this second meaning of Big Bang is that it's not very successful as a scientific hypothesis because it leaves big questions about the universe unanswered. It turns out that our universe had to have started in an extraordinarily special state to have evolved into anything like our universe. The hypothesis that there was a first moment of time is remarkably generic and unconstraining, as it's consistent with an infinite number of possible states in which the universe might have begun. This follows from a theorem proved by Stephen Hawking and Roger Penrose, that almost any expanding universe described by general relativity has such a first moment of time. Compared to almost all of these, our own early universe was extraordinarily homogeneous and symmetric. Why? If the Big Bang was the first moment of time, there can be no scientific answer, because there was no before on which to base an explanation. At this point, theologians see their opening, and indeed have been lining up at the gates of science to impose their kind of explanation, that God made the universe and made it so. Similarly, if the Big Bang was the first moment of time, there can be no scientific answer to the question of what chose the laws of nature. This leaves the field open to explanations such as the anthropic multiverse, which are unscientific because they call on unobservable collections of other universes and make no predictions by which their hypotheses might be tested and falsified. There is, however, a chance for science to answer these questions, and that's if the Big Bang was not the first moment of time, but a transition from an earlier era of the universe, an era that can be investigated scientifically because processes acting then would have given rise to our world. For there to have been a time before the Big Bang, the Hawking-Penrose theorem must fail, but there's a simple reason to think it must. General relativity is incomplete as a description of nature because it leaves out quantum phenomena. Unifying quantum physics with general relativity has been a major challenge for fundamental physics, one on which there has been much progress in the last 30 years. In spite of the absence of a definitive solution to the problem, there's robust evidence from quantum cosmology models that the infinite singularities forcing time to stop in general relativity are eliminated, turning the Big Bang, in the sense of a first moment of time, into a big bounce, which allows time to continue to exist before the Big Bang, deep into the past. Detailed models of quantum universes show a prior era ending with a collapse, where the density increases to very high values, but before the universe becomes infinitely dense, quantum processes take over which bounce the collapse into an expansion, launching a new era that could be our expanding universe. There are currently several scenarios under study for what happened in the era before the Big Bang and how it transitioned to our expanding universe. Two of them hypothesize a quantum bounce and go under the name of loop quantum cosmology and geometrogenesis. Two others, due respectively to Roger Penrose and to Paul Steinhardt and Neil Turok, describe cyclical scenarios in which universes die, giving rise to new universes. A fifth posits that new universes are launched when quantum effects bounce black hole singularities. These scenarios offer insights as to how the laws of nature governing our universe might have been chosen, and they may also explain how the initial conditions of our universe evolved from the previous universe. The important thing is that each of these hypotheses makes predictions for real, doable observations by which they might be falsified and distinguished from one another. During the 20th century, we learned a great deal about the first 3 minutes, in Steven Weinberg's phrase, of our expanding universe. During this century, we can look forward to gaining scientific evidence of the last 3 minutes of the era before ours and learning how physics before the Big Bang gave rise to the birth of our universe. The universe began in a state of extraordinary low entropy. Alan Guth, cosmologist. Victor F. Weisskopf, professor of physics, MIT. Inaugural winner, Milner Foundation's Fundamental Physics Prize. Author, The Inflationary Universe. The roots of this issue go back to at least 1865, when Rudolf Clausius coined the term entropy and stated that the entropy of the universe tends to a maximum. This idea is now known as the second law of thermodynamics, which is most often stated thus: the entropy of an isolated system always increases or stays constant, but never decreases. Isolated systems tend to evolve toward the state of maximum entropy, the state of thermodynamic equilibrium. Even though entropy will play a crucial role in this discussion, it will suffice to use a fairly crude definition. Entropy is a measure of the disorder of a physical system. In the underlying quantum description, entropy is a measure of the number of quantum states corresponding to a given description in terms of macroscopic variables such as temperature, volume, and density. The classic example is a gas in a closed box. If we start with all the gas molecules in a corner of the box, we can imagine watching what happens next. The gas molecules will fill the box, increasing the entropy to the maximum. But it never goes the other way. If the gas molecules fill the box, we'll never see them spontaneously collect into one corner. This behavior seems natural, but it is hard to reconcile with our understanding of the underlying laws of physics. The gas makes a huge distinction between the past and the future, always evolving toward larger entropy in the future. This one-way behavior of matter in bulk is called the arrow of time. Nonetheless, the microscopic laws that describe collisions of molecules are time-symmetric, making no distinction between past and future. Any movie of a collision could be played backward, and it would also show a valid picture of the collision. To account for some very rare events discovered by particle physicists, the movie is guaranteed to be valid only if it is also reflected in a mirror and has every particle relabeled as the corresponding antiparticle. But these complications don't change the key issue. There's an important problem, therefore, which is over a century old. To understand how the arrow of time could possibly arise from time-symmetric laws of evolution. The arrow of time mystery has driven physicists to seek possible causes within the laws of physics we observe, but in vain. The laws make no distinction between the past and the future. Physicists have understood, however, that a low entropy state is always likely to evolve into a higher entropy state simply because there are many more states of higher entropy. Thus, the entropy today is higher than the entropy yesterday, because yesterday the universe was in a low entropy state, and it was in a low entropy state yesterday because the day before that it was in an even lower entropy state. The traditional understanding follows this pattern back to the origin of the universe, attributing the arrow of time to some not well understood property of cosmic initial conditions, which created the universe in a special low entropy state. As Brian Greene wrote in The Fabric of the Cosmos, "The ultimate source of order, of low entropy, must be the Big Bang itself. The egg splatters rather than unsplatters, because it is carrying forward the drive toward higher entropy that was initiated by the extraordinarily low entropy state with which the universe began." Based on an elaboration of a 2004 proposal by Sean Carroll and Jennifer Chen, there's a possibility of a new solution to the age-old problem of the arrow of time. This work, by Sean Carroll, Qian Yao Tseng, and me, is still in the realm of speculation and hasn't yet been vetted by the scientific community. But it seems to provide an attractive alternative to the standard picture. The standard picture holds that the initial conditions for the universe must have produced a special low-entropy state because one is needed to explain the arrow of time. No such assumption is applied to the final state, so the arrow of time is introduced through a time-asymmetric condition. We argue, to the contrary, that the arrow of time can be explained without assuming a special initial state, so there's no longer any motivation for the hypothesis that the universe began in a state of extraordinarily low entropy. The most attractive feature of this idea is that there's no longer a need to introduce any assumptions that violate the time symmetry of the known laws of physics. The basic idea is simple. We don't really know if the maximum possible entropy for the universe is finite or infinite, so let's assume it's infinite. Then, no matter what entropy the universe started with, the entropy would have been low compared with its maximum. That's all that's needed to explain why the entropy has been rising ever since. The metaphor of gas in a box is replaced by a gas with no box. In the context of what physicists call a toy model, that is, one meant to illustrate a basic principle without trying to be otherwise realistic, we can imagine choosing, in a random and time-symmetric way, an initial state for a gas composed of some finite number of non-interacting particles. It's important here that any well-defined state will have a finite value for the entropy and a finite value for the maximum distance of any particle from the origin of our coordinate system. If such a system is followed into the future, the particles might move inward or outward for some finite time, but ultimately the inward-moving particles will pass the central region and will start moving outward. All particles will eventually be moving outward, and the gas will continue indefinitely to expand into the infinite space, with the entropy rising without limit. An arrow of time, the steady growth of entropy with time, has been generated without introducing any time-asymmetric assumptions. An interesting feature of this picture is that the universe need not have a beginning, but could be continued from where we started in both directions of time. Since the laws of evolution and the initial state are time-symmetric, the past will be statistically equivalent to the future. Observers in the deep past will see the arrow of time in the opposite direction from ours, but their experience will be no different from ours. Entropy. Bruce Parker, oceanographer, visiting professor, Center for Maritime Systems, Stevens Institute of Technology. Author, The Power of the Sea. Could one really have the nerve to suggest retiring the idea of entropy? I don't believe we abandon old ideas before new ones are developed. Old ideas disappear or are modified only when new, better ideas are developed. They're never just retired. So, no, we shouldn't retire entropy, but perhaps we should treat it with a little less importance and recognize the paradox it creates. Entropy, the measure of the degree of disorder in a system, has held a lofty place in physics, being part of a law, no less, not just a theory. The second law of thermodynamics says that in any closed system, entropy always increases with time. Unless work is done to prevent it, the closed system will eventually reach maximum entropy and a state of thermal equilibrium. Max Planck believed that entropy, along with energy, was the most important property of physical systems. In The Nature of the Physical World, 1927, Sir Arthur Eddington wrote, "The law that entropy always increases, the second law of thermodynamics, holds, I think, the supreme position among the laws of nature." But as a young physics student in college, I must admit I never understood their excitement. And I was not the only student to be unimpressed. The second law seemed of minor importance compared with the first law of thermodynamics, the conservation of energy. Energy could be transformed into different forms, but it was always conserved. The first law had beautiful partial differential equations, as do all the conservation equations of physics, whose solutions accurately described and predicted so much of the world and literally changed our lives. The second law was not a conservation equation and had no beautiful partial differential equations. It wasn't even an equality. Has the idea of entropy and the second law had any major effect on science and engineering or changed the world? The second law was a statistical law. Initially, a generalization of conclusions reached when looking at the motion of molecules or particles. As students, we could easily understand the classic example of how hot, fast-moving molecules on one side of a closed box mixed with cold, slow-moving molecules on the other side, and why they couldn't separate again once they were together and all at the same temperature. We understood why it was irreversible. And we understood the concept of the arrow of time. Sure, the mathematics of the first law and the other conservation equations of physics worked in both directions of time, but with initial conditions and boundary conditions, we always knew which way things moved. It didn't seem to require another law. In fact, the second law, as applied now to all situations, seemed to be an assumption rather than a law, especially when it was applied to the entire universe, which we understand so little about. Where the universe, whatever that entails, which may be more than our presently visible observable universe, is concerned, the first law tells us that all the energy in it will be conserved, although perhaps converted into various forms. But the second law says that at some time in the future no more energy transformations can take place. The universe will reach some stage of maximum entropy and thermal equilibrium. The second law essentially says that the universe must have had a beginning and an end. That's very difficult to accept. The universe must be timeless, for if there was a beginning, what was there before this beginning? Something cannot come out of nothing, and by nothing I mean the lack of anything, even things we don't know about yet. Of course, the present Big Bang theory posits a beginning, of sorts, and our present form of the universe has apparently expanded from a singularity. But we don't know what came before that, and oscillating models of the universe are being proposed so that the universe is timeless. With such models, if entropy is very high at the end of our universe and was very low at the beginning of our universe, what process could essentially reset entropy to a low value? As relates to an oscillating universe, should entropy perhaps be conserved somehow? Could there be some type of energy conversion that doesn't require work in our classical sense? Could the universe actually be the one and only possible perpetual motion machine, a contraption forbidden by the second law? If existence is endless in time, it would seem so. The whole idea of entropy has always felt wrong or misplaced in other ways also. We talk about the universe going from order to disorder, yet this supposed order is merely the compression of all the universe's matter in some tiny volume, a singularity, and when it expanded there was less order because the particles were more spread out. And yet order is being created all the time. The greatest result of our expanding and evolving universe is its ever-increasing complexity. First, from gravity condensing matter, then from supernovae creating higher number elements, then from chemical evolution, and then from biological evolution, driven by natural selection, which culminated in self-reproducing life and eventually the incredible complexity of our brains. Complexity is synonymous with low entropy. The expanding universe has countless small, relative to the universe's size, pockets of extremely low entropy surrounded by vast areas of higher entropy, much of which resulted from the creation of these low entropy areas. Are the higher orders of complexity, and thus lower orders of entropy, taken into account in attempts to balance the entropy of the universe? Many current scientific papers in cosmology try to sum up the universe's total entropy with formulas that may well be far too simple to account for all the as-yet-unknown physics going on in our strange universe. We cannot retire entropy, but should we maybe rethink it?